On behalf of Het Europa House or the European Parliament or the Information Office of the European Parliament of the Montesquieu Institute and Campus The Hague, I would like to welcome you here on the first debate that we are organizing this fall. The second one will be on December 7th, so I'm sure that will be interesting again, and if you've got your diary with you, it would be good if you jot that down. Today we're going to talk about the new media and democracy, and the question is whether or not new media are an asset to democracy. And one of my colleagues from another university than Leiden, but from University of Amsterdam, Andrea Schuk, is going to say some things about that. He specializes in media science, and he will probably want to say something more than just this about what he's doing, because I'm sure it's very interesting. So the talk will be about half an hour, and after that we'll have a discussion. And for those of you who haven't seen them before, the statements are on a piece of paper that you can find on your chair. I will be the chair during the discussion. I will just pick at random one or more of the statements that we will talk about. And when we do, then Andreas will first give his opinion about the statement, and then the room can just say whatever they like. One thing about the discussion, I would really appreciate it if not everybody starts yelling and shouting at the same time. We will have two of these microphones, so my assistant, my beautiful assistant Rhea, and I will walk in the room, and but I will be the one to decide who will ask a question. And if you ask a question, please make a short introduction and not an introduction plus one question and another one and another one and another one, because, you know, we hope that everybody here will have a chance if he or she wants to ask a question. So please, a little bit of discipline will make everything much more fun. And after about 45 minutes of discussion, you are all invited for drinks. So we will hope when we leave the room here and the building, we will all be very happy and walking very nicely. But for now, I would like to give the floor to Andreas to give his speech, and after that we'll dive into discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Andreas Schuk. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Amsterdam for political communication. I'm actually particularly happy to be here and speak in front of a European Union group, because I actually spent 3 years of my life studying media effects on the outcome of the Dutch constitution referendum. So don't tell me if you voted no or nay in that referendum, but if you have any question how the media had an effect or not on the outcome of that referendum, I'm happy to talk to you afterwards. Why was I invited to be here today? Because my core interest is political participation and political mobilization and the impact of media on that. So not only new media, but also more traditional media. And in Amsterdam, we are kind of a large research group of people who all do research on the question, how is the European Union covered in the media, and what effect does that have on public opinion about Europe, or on voting in European elections or referendums, to give some examples. But I was invited today to talk about new media. And everybody, of course, loves the internet, and everybody is very excited about the internet. So just in the last 5 years, the number of internet users worldwide has doubled. So we now have more than 2 billion people who are online. We have some countries where, in fact, access to the internet is a legal right, such as Estonia or Finland or Spain. But we also have some big differences if we kind of look at the distribution of online access. So in Africa, less than 10% have online access, even though due to spreading mobile devices, we can actually assume that to change quite rapidly. But yet we see a large difference, of course. We have more than 71% of people in the developed countries, so-called developed countries, who are online, and only 21% in developing countries. So with this rise of internet access, a lot of hopes obviously came about with regard to how the internet could impact democracy. And obviously, it's a very short jump only to assume that with more people being online, it should also be possible to enhance democracy and strengthen democracy. And a couple of new media have kind of developed, or new platforms have developed to kind of foster this optimism. If we look at the Netherlands, we have reached a point of saturation, I would say, in the Netherlands a couple of years back. So we assume that now more or less 90% are online and are online regularly. This is obviously much more than the world average, which by now is about 30%. But what are these new kind of platforms that now everybody is so excited about, and which I am, of course, trying to challenge that they are yet so wonderful? A couple of things have had an impact, I would say. So on the first, we see that people, we have something like developed citizen journalism, so everyday people kind of contribute user-generated content to newsrooms. So basically, the boundaries between journalists and regular people seems to be kind of vanishing. We have a lot of blogs. 176 million blogs are usually tracked on the Nielsen company website. We have discussion forums with commenting functions. We have chat rooms. We have social networks, comment sections on regular news websites. So obviously the idea is that this is all good for political deliberation and contributes to democracy. And when we look at social networks a little bit more in particular, since they are in the title of today's session here, we know that 3/4 of young adults in the US are a member of one or the other social networking site. And in the Netherlands, even 98% of those people online below the age of 30 are member of social networking sites. We also know that, for example, in the last Obama election, 1/4 of US citizens actually reported that they got news on this election on social networking sites. So all of this seems to kind of point to the relevance of this and seems to show that indeed these new forums are very influential. Couple of graphs. This is the growth of Facebook accounts. And as you can see, it stops in 2010. And not to shock you, it has actually almost doubled since then to September 2011. So we actually are now, latest numbers from last month, 712 million accounts. So as you can see, 1st of January 2010, this was had just cracked the 400 million. Now we have 712. That's a 12-month growth rate of more than 40%. We have growth rates in particular countries like Brazil from more than 300%, India 160%, Thailand 130%, and more than 150 million US citizens are on Facebook. A couple of more facts about Facebook. We know that half of Facebook users actually are logging onto their Facebook account every day. The average user has 130 friends, so you can now kind of check if you're popular or maybe not with this. There are more than 900 million objects that people interact with. Can be pages, can be groups, can be communities. We also know that every day 250 million photos are uploaded on Facebook. It's offered in more than 70 languages, and users have in fact contributed to these translations. And we know that 350 million Facebook users access Facebook also with their mobile phones, mobile devices. Very impressive. This is the number of Twitter users, new Twitter users a month. And as you can see, from 2008 onwards, we have a rapid increase. This is another chart that tells you that 44% of Twitter users joined between January and August 2010. This is the number of tweets per day worldwide. And also with regard to very particular issues, we see that Twitter has become quite relevant. This is, for example, a chart that shows the number of tweets per second when Obama announced that Osama bin Laden was killed. And you can see how it develops over the day. And at peak time, we have more than 5,000 tweets a second. That is kind of relating to this event happening. So significant traffic. But also in the Netherlands, if we look at the last elections, we can see that people tweeting about politicians, so mentioning their names or whatever sort of nicknames or abbreviation. I actually talked to people who have to identify nicknames of politicians and then make sure that these statistics are correct. So it's quite interesting nicknames for some politicians. But anyway, this is kind of the aggregated numbers, and you can see that in the last week of the campaign, the discussion on Twitter about the election also increased. You can also, actually, if you want to, get your daily news diet via Twitter. Just sign up, you know, for example, here, become a follower, and get your daily news diet directly via Twitter. Now, of course, these charts all seem to indicate that this is, you know, something really grand happening here, very dynamic, recent, and, you know, the numbers in absolute terms are already crazy, but the growth rates are even more crazy, so it also doesn't seem to stop. And, of course, a couple of other things that you all, of course, know a lot about, you know, that all contributes to this optimistic perspective that new media really, really matter today and today's democracy, was, of course, this groundbreaking a tool that Barack Obama employed in his campaign, the mybarackobama.com. I don't know if you signed up. I woke up and got emails from Michelle Obama personally addressing me, dear Andreas. I mean, obviously, you know, via a certain software. She was not really writing me. That would be troubling. But obviously, a kind of a new tool to organize and publicize campaign rallies, to build momentum, to build movement, what Obama was praised for so much, to organize fundraising, to organize online town hall discussion forums, to store information, and to retrieve information. But some people think that Obama was the first. That's actually not true. The first was Howard Dean in the election before the Obama election, 2003-04, who also already employed this forum, which I guess most of you don't know unless you're American, and even then you might not know it. But Meetup.com was kind of the tool that Howard Dean in the election 2003-2004 already employed, and he didn't even do so much about it. It was more his supporters kind of taking this forum and organizing themselves to organize fundraising rallies, all these kinds of things. And the last thing, and of course I have to mention this, is of course the Arab Spring. Also here, the impression being that new media really, really matter. Where would we have gotten all these reports from if not via social media, Twitter, Facebook, all these tools? Because obviously there was no regular coverage, you know, that could reach us here. So basically, it seems kind of a suicidal enterprise now to tell you that social media are maybe not all that important after this build-up, because obviously, if we look at all these figures, at all these facts, they seem to be very objective and undeniable. And I think there is a common sense that even if you don't know much about these media, even if you don't subscribe to them and don't have a Facebook account yourself, there is a common sense that these things really seem to matter. But as I am from a university, I, of course, am interested in kind of empirical research. So basically, I think there is vast agreement that the normative potential of all these media is big. It's undeniable that they provide a forum for discussion, all the things that I already kind of alluded to. But the question now is, are there measurable effects of this? Is this actually more than just a promise? Is it also empirical reality that democracy has changed, that political participation has increased, for example? Is this really the case? So we have to distinguish between a more subjective sense of these new media are very effective, and the question, is there really an objective change in the way people are involved, the information they get, all these kinds of things. A quote of Matthew Hindman, who's a Harvard fellow and a professor at the University of Washington and quite significant in this whole debate, captures this quite nicely, and he says, too often normative debates about the internet have gotten ahead of the evidence. So what is the evidence? In very basic terms, we can distinguish between two perspectives here. The first perspective is basically the one that I started off with. So basically the idea that the internet will reform politics. And as a consequence of that, also redistribute political power, kind of giving it more into the hands of the people. And the idea that the internet or technology as such has the power to shape society and politics. The other perspective that where you also find researchers kind of picking up that claim would be that is entitled here as the normalized. So the idea that actually current political relationships will just be replicated online. So it might be that politicians make use of social networks, start Twittering, all these kinds of things, but that in the very end, actually not much will change. And the idea that basically, as with the introduction of every new medium, there is an initial hype, but actually not so much will change after. We can further distinguish this then a little bit. So here, the optimist perspective and arguments, because I now try to summarize a whole bulk of literature that is kind of picking up these claims. So these studies basically saying, okay, more people will get involved. That's very good. It will facilitate discussion. People will participate more. There will be more deliberation. So the quality of discourse is getting better. There's mobilization taking place. And it will all revitalize democracy because we're living at times with dropping turnouts in elections, all these kinds of things. So basically, the arrival of new media as being sort of a partial medicine for this dilemma that many democracies are facing today when it comes to citizen involvement. Then the pessimist perspective, which basically says, okay, it's not only that existing power relations are basically just repeated online, but since it's especially the young people and especially the smart people, the well-equipped people, this perspective even gets to a negative statement because it says, okay, it actually deepens the divide in society because some people are more quick to pick up technical innovations and others are kind of more left behind. They might also participate, but at a slower rate so that we actually have a democratic divide in the long run as a result of new media. And then we have the last perspective, which I here call skepticism, which is in between the first two. So it's less optimistic than the first perspective, but it's also not really saying that it's harmful what's going on right now. So this perspective would kind of say that it's all politics as usual. The internet does not destroy anything or leave anyone behind, but it does also maybe not change politics as we know it. So this perspective very much picking up claims that when television arrived or radio arrived, people got very excited about these new possibilities. But in the end, we just see things repeating. So basically, discussions now maybe taking place online, but it's still the kind of the same content with the same reach and so on. So we have these different positions now. You can all ask yourself already and equip yourself if you should be chosen randomly, as was announced in the beginning, in which of these camps you basically would place yourself. But since I started off with all these impressive numbers and figures, the question still is, how can one not be an optimist? Now that you have seen all these wonderful charts and everything is going up, 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 different to current stock market rates, it seems these numbers all go up. So let me start off by casting some initial doubt. This, what you see here, is the age of users of Twitter. I would be very impressed if we maybe have somebody above 55 here who actually belongs to this. Very good. To this, what is it? If you aggregate it, it's maybe 1% of Twitter users that are above 55. But more importantly, we have 80% of people being below the age of 30. We have comparable statistics for Facebook, where it's a little bit less, so it's 72% that is below 35. Admittedly, what one has to say is that we also have rather large growth rates in the older age segments. So it's not that this is written in stone, but we also see increases in the older age bracket. Nevertheless, it's I think pretty obvious. Not a normal distribution. Now, when we look at age, this is kind of asking people during the U.S. election in 2008 where they kind of got information about the campaign from, and if they watched campaign videos online. So these are data from the Pew Research Center. And what we see here, that it's mainly in the age group between 18 and 29, where people say, okay, I use social network sites, and that is where I got information about the campaign. Same for online videos, so on YouTube. Coming to gender, we have a gender gap when we look at Twitter users. So as the cliche might already suggest, we do know that Twitter users are more male than female. We have the same difference in direction when it comes to Facebook, but much less. So the gender bias is not as big with Facebook. Excuse me? The cliche of basically, when I come to the pirate party in Germany later, which is a party that comes out of the internet kind of community, and it's 95% male. Sort of, yeah. I wanted to avoid the word nerd, but basically, yes. Then, with regard to geographic location, we see that although there are lots of twittering and tweets going around the world, also here the distribution is quite different and centered in certain parts of the world. So obviously this phenomenon is not one that is equally important or equally prominent around the whole world. And interestingly, when we look at who tweets, then we actually also see that we have some very active people and then a vast majority of people that only tweet very rarely. So actually 22.5% of the users post 90% of the tweets. So we have quite an active smaller group and a bigger group that is only occasionally tweeting. But this was just casting some initial doubt. And now you might wonder, who is this man? This is Aristotle, but he's just a shifter for letting science speak. So he obviously is not having to say anything about Twitter. But anyway, what do we now know when we look at actual empirical scientific studies? And I'm very happy to actually present some very, very fresh findings from colleagues of mine at the University of Amsterdam, which are actually so fresh that the paper is in press, so it's not even published yet, but I have the permission to tell you what they found. So what did they find? They conducted a representative survey in the Netherlands with more than 2,000 people aged 13 and above, and they wanted to know, okay, who is actually using blogs, Twitter, discussion forums, social networks like Facebook, who comments on news sites, and when people do they do that with political content or general content? So how political is, for example, Twitter use or Facebook use? And they distinguish between passive use and active use. So passive use would be that you just read a tweet, for example, or you join a group, or you watch a video, whereas active would be you produce. So you write, you publish, you comment. So this distinction is made in this study. And what they look for is, okay, how large is actually the share of the Dutch population that is actually involved in these kinds of networks. And what they find is the following. So when we first talk about general consumption, so that would be you don't produce and it's not about politics, then we actually see that there is quite some use of blogs, forums, comments, and social networks. However, looking at Twitter, for example, we see that only 6% of this representative sample in the Netherlands actually says that they read tweets. So this is not writing them or producing them themselves or commenting on them, just reading. If we then kind of ask how much of this is political, then the numbers drop quite a lot. What we only see is that about 20% or 19% read political comments on news sites. But of course, these numbers now further drop when we look at political participation, so that people actually actively produce something. And what we see here is quite high numbers for social networks or uploading photos and videos, but only 3% say that they have ever basically participated on Twitter, which means that they have produced something on Twitter, they have written something or they have commented something. And this is non-political, so this is general. And if we look at political, then we find that only 0.6% has actually said that they at least once a month sent a political tweet, so a tweet with a political reference or a content. And when we look at social networks like Facebook, it's 2.7% that has at least once a month done something that qualifies as political. This was defined in the questionnaire. I can talk about that later if you're interested in, so what is political. So these numbers are obviously, as you can see for yourself, very low. So basically what we're referring to here is social network participation political of 2.7% with 0.6%. My colleagues and I were actually very surprised when we got these data back, because if you consider how prominent this topic has become also in or as part of news coverage, in Amsterdam we just held a big debate on Twitter and politics, and we had politicians invited who talked about their experience with Twitter, then it is pretty striking how small, in fact, these numbers are looking at the general population. So what we can conclude from this study is that the majority of people is not consuming or participating in politics via Twitter or social networking sites like Facebook. Among those that are at least doing something, most only consume but don't produce. So don't actively participate. 77% of our sample said that they never or hardly ever read political content on blogs, tweets, comment sections, or what have you. And 94% of the sample say that they have never or hardly ever participated in any of these platforms when it comes to political content. Mind you, we already adopted a very lenient classification, once a month. That's already very low, in fact. So the numbers are even lower, of course, when you look at more regular use, like once a week. We also asked people why don't they become more active? We found that the main reasons were fear of privacy and the feeling that contributions have no effect, have no impact. So those were the two dominant reasons why people reported that they might read content on these sites, but they don't actively contribute themselves. Another reason was that we found that people said that they find the discussions uncivil. So that was another reason. This could, of course, change over time. We don't know. But for now, this seems to be another problem. There's also some other research outside the Netherlands analyzing contents of political blogs and discussions, and also concluding that there's not much deliberation in a Habermasian sense going on in most of us. In a Habermasian sense. In an ideal democratic idea of everybody can talk, there's no hierarchy, and so basically the high ideal of democracy. Another thing that this study also found was that those people who are involved are the usual suspects. So it's people who are already politically interested, have a strong sense of political efficacy, so they think they matter, they think they can have an impact, and they have some technical affinity. So this is kind of feeding into one of the three perspectives I presented to you. So the idea that it's not really the disengaged that are picking this up, but rather those who are actually already more engaged. What I should stress, of course, is that this is a Dutch study. It's actually the first study that uses a representative sample to look for answers to these questions. But we should, of course, be careful to generalize this and now talk about, you know, these results as being applicable to Europe or outside that. That's, of course, not possible. couple of other findings that I wanted to share with you. This is a pretty influential study in the field, kind of looking at social networking website and political engagement of young adults. So also using a survey among young voters in the US, and they basically also did not find very optimistic findings when it comes to political participation as a result of social networking site use. So people did not gain political information substantially through their use of social networking sites. It was conform with existing political views, what they came across. And they also showed that users of social networking sites are not more likely to participate in offline politics, but they are more likely to engage in online political activity, so in less traditional forms of political participation. These are the two gentlemen I just referred to, and this is basically their conclusion. Our sense is that the hyperbole surrounding new web developments as they relate to citizenship may be just that, a hype. In fact, it is reminiscent of earlier hopes for Web 1.0 and before that television and even earlier developments in mass communications technology. The contention that social networking websites will spur a democratic revolution may be overstated. Yeah, some last findings that also kind of tie into this more skeptical perspective. There are some studies looking at campaign websites and also the kind of functions on campaign websites to spur interactivity. And what they found was that the people visiting campaign websites, for example, were not significantly more engaged, and that only those people who are already pretty engaged are kind of further mobilized by this. So when we kind of tie this all up, we can maybe conclude something along the lines for this perspective, as Schäuble and Nisbet say here. So they kind of conclude the democratic potential of the internet is limited. They also show that using the web for entertainment purposes, which of course many people do, even shows that people become less trusting and less efficacious and less knowledgeable. And they conclude that traditional mass media maintain their key role in promoting citizenship. And to get those of you who are heavy Twitterers really upset, a last quote by a study basically saying, okay, this whole idea that journalism has changed so much and audiences have actually, you know, merged with journalists, that this is actually not the case. So journalists have remained journalists, audiences. So political news use on these websites is in fact not so widespread. So is it all just a myth is now the question. What I try to do now is, of course, follow ancient rhetoric, in fact, by Cicero, for example, who says, okay, first build a strong case and then debunk it and then kind of, you know, say why the first part was true nevertheless. Yeah, and that is, of course, now what I do to become friends again with those Twitter people who are now really upset in the audience. So is it really true that it's all so negative as I have just said, or maybe not? Well, there is, of course, some evidence that one should take into consideration and that also weighs in heavily. So we have some studies that basically say, okay, there are so many different ways to engage citizens in politics and let them participate in politics. And some of these are maybe not even so easy to measure in quantifiable terms. So as a matter of fact, these new media do provide access to news and more information. They can link candidates and citizens. They provide space for political discussion. And you can also get a sense of what's going on in public debate and public opinion. So this particular study here is not an empirical study, but they stress the importance to also consider the symbolic empowerment of people. So the sense of, well, maybe people don't go and vote more now that they have these new media channels, but they might actually have more of a sense of being a citizen and actually, you know, engaging in a dialogue. And that does not have to be something that, you know, must be measurable with quantifiable outcomes, basically. Nevertheless, there are some empirical studies that are more in this optimistic paradigm. So And they all basically stress that if there are effects, they might be indirect, but there might be some these indirect effects. So, for example, using new media can foster political discussion and civic messaging, and that in turn can influence political participation, so more of an indirect effect. There are also some studies that focus on how online discussions translate into political engagement offline. So first, basically, people meet online, discuss things, and this then actually also in a more indirect way results later on in more offline participation. And some studies stress that we have to distinguish much more in research, in empirical research, between the different sites. Because it's true that by now, this is a new research field, and very often studies kind of just merge this all together and say, you know, social media use, like how much do you use and how often? But given that they all have very different utility functions, some offer, you know, more discussion forums, others don't, it is actually relevant to distinguish and look at these individually. And some first studies have actually shown that then you come to different conclusions. Now, this is a last study I want to show you and then leave it with that. So this study was conducted in the Netherlands and was did a web survey and a web experiment. And it did show that people who use more social networking sites, that this might actually have a slight effect, not a very strong effect, but a slight effect to get people who are not so interested in politics a little bit more interested. They also show that viewing candidate profiles on social networking sites strengthens existing attitudes towards that candidate and may be interesting for politicians. I don't know if we have one in the audience, but politicians who actually react on comments of users are seen as more favorable. So basically they get a gratification by the citizen or by the voter for having responded, if you want so. Now, I first have kind of shown you the picture of a new media being very much on the uprise and apparently becoming very, very important or just being very important. Then I have been casting some initial doubt. Then I presented you some research findings that actually show, well, maybe it's really overstated. Then I have shown you a couple of findings that seem to indicate that there are some sort of effects, not very strong or direct, but nevertheless important. I now want to kind of conclude with stressing a couple of things that I think undeniably have in fact changed as a result of the rise of these new media, and that are, aside from the question, you know, do people now go and vote more, or do they kind of become more politically interested, that are maybe more grander general trends that we witness. The first one is that politics is changing in light of these developments. This is actually not new. We have seen this with regard to the emergence of other media just as well, but kind of once more getting back to the Howard Dean example that I mentioned a little bit earlier, who was, as I said, a candidate running for the Democrats in the 2003 primaries for the 2004 election. And it was not his idea to become such a new media candidate, but he was kind of made a new media candidate by his supporters. So he says, along comes this campaign to take back the country for ordinary human beings, and the best way you can do that is through the net. We listen, we pay attention. If I give a speech and the block people don't like it, next time I change the speech. Now, of course, I put this on because there is one of the Stellingen for today that is kind of referring to the question, is it dangerous? So I think we'll get back to that question. But as a response to this quote, we actually have a quote by a political blogger, Derek James, who says, I'd vote for SpongeBob SquarePants, that's a polite, friendly guy over on the right, over Howard Dean, but his campaign organization is being run in a very smart, very democratic way. So something we can, of course, discuss is if this, what we in science call mediatization, so that actually politics responds to developments in media, if that is a good thing or not. Is this actually you know, something one should want from a democratic perspective, that actually politics adapts to this extent? I mean, this is, of course, an extreme example. Or is this actually something we don't want? We have a quote here from Steve McMahon, who was one of the campaign managers to make the link to the Obama campaign, which is, of course, much more present, I think, for many here. So he says, the Obama for President campaign is what all of us hope Dean for President would become. Obama is Dean 2.0, dramatically updated to reflect the emergence of the grassroots. And I think the grassroots aspect is indeed one that is something that will remain. So you can all already sign up for the Barack Obama 2012 campaign. I already did, so I actually already now got my first email from Michelle Obama again. So it's already all up and running. But basically the idea of the grassroots obviously was very prominent in the 2008 campaign. And I'll show you a couple of examples in a second that have nothing to do with Obama, how this, of course, now really sticks with us, I think. First here, this is not Dean's, but Obama's new media campaign strategist. So this is what he has to say. The Obama campaign prioritized the web because it provided access to the very heart of the organization, ordinary people. The campaign used the web to lower the barrier to entry for as many people as possible and develop relationships that turned those people into activists, donors, and leaders. And I think that is indeed something that was only possible because of new media and that will actually stick with think of the Occupy movement that I actually have been to a conference in Madrid and I didn't even know that Madrid is also big in the Occupy movement. But I actually woke up with people singing the Internazionale below my hotel window. And so a big event there in Frankfurt, in Germany, in many European countries and outside Europe, of course, too. So this kind of movement, of course, developed, I mean, would not be possible to think of this without the technical infrastructure that basically new media have provided. Of course, we can expect that most people who kind of set this up and who actually got active were politically active people before. But we can, of course, assume that, you know, a significant number of people, if we look at the number of people joining these demonstrations, have joined this and are maybe now more involved than they have been before. In Germany, and since that is my home country, please bear with the German language poster for a second. We have the already briefly mentioned Pirate Party, which is a party that was born out of a kind of a movement of internet, I don't want to call them activists, but people very, active on the internet, so I guess that makes them activists, who are who very much fought against a law that was supposed to be passed where they saw the their privacy being threatened. So basically, this party now has been running for the first time, not for the first time, but in a significant in significant terms for the first time, in the Berlin local elections and got 9% of the votes. I heard that you had Guido Westerwelle here 1 or 2 or 3 weeks ago. His party in that same election got 2%. And this party actually doesn't have much of a program. It doesn't even have much of a party structure. It doesn't. It has officially a party head, but it's they debate and negotiate their policies online without basically necessarily meeting and different people kind of determining the course of events at different times, depending on who's online. So this is really a party born out of the internet that kind of takes advantage of all these new possibilities. And, you know, obviously, this is a significant shift. At the moment, this party is predicted to gain about 6% of the votes in the next German national elections. That's above the 5% hurdle. I mean, again, Guido Westerwelle's party only has 3% at the moment. So this is pretty significant. Then, last point here, or second last point, of course, another thing that has changed with these new possibilities is, in a euphemistic, positive way, you could say there's more transparency now. You know, things are much more likely to come out. I don't know who knows this example, but we had the senator of Virginia, George Allen, who was followed by this young man, who was an activist for the opponent, and he took videos of speeches by this by the senator each and everywhere this senator went. He just taped it. And at some point, he lost his nerves, and he was shouting at this man, There you are again. Welcome to America, macaca. And that is a degrading word, basically referring to the non-American origin of this person. This has been watched by hundreds of thousands of people on YouTube. He lost the election by a very small margin. Of course, we can't, you know, scientifically claim that that was because of this event. But since the margin was very, very low, we might at least speculate, you know, what the impact of this has been. Now, again, from a democratic viewpoint, the question would be, you know, is this good that we actually get to see much more, you know, when we have people out there who actually tape everything? Or is this actually something that, you know, is not to be appreciated so much by all of us? Last point I want to make before I leave it up to you is that journalism changes. So not only politics changes, not only do we have new technical infrastructure that allows for all these kind of movements that I just referred to, but what you of course also see is that journalists and the way journalists cover politics is changing. So we see, for example, a vast increase of using Twitter as a source. So journalists basically using Twitter sites of politicians. We also see that politicians and journalists use one Twitter account. They don't have a professional and a private account, very many of them, but this is merging too. And we just conducted an experiment at the University of Amsterdam because we were thinking that this new style of news reporting, that people would trust Twitter sources less because it's Twitter. But it's actually not true. It's actually not true. Twitter does not have lower credibility for people like the... And I mean, now again, don't think of your cohort, but think of your, you know, parents' cohort as well. There's no significant difference in the credibility people assign to statements that have been tweeted as opposed to other statements. Now, last chart, because I know that there are lots of Stellingen, and these are not meant to be Stellingen, but I at least want to let you know what are actually things that we... you know, who do research on this, kind of keep ourselves busy with in the upcoming time period. I think one very central question is, what is political participation today? Because all these studies try to show effects or non-effects of these new media on the way people participate politically. But obviously, you know, back in the days, political participation was voting, being a party member, these kinds of things. And when you look at the different studies, they have very different operationalizations of political participation. What is political participation today? When you buy biological food in Albert Heijn, is that already political or is it not? Is it civic engagement? Is it political engagement? So there's a confusion about these terms in the literature that also explains a lot of contradicting findings, because you have a lot of studies that, you know, are optimistic, a lot of studies that are come to very different conclusions. Second question, I think, is not yet settled. So who gets more engaged, and, you know, how do we assess engagement? So does it include people who kind of see these new media as alternative ways of getting involved? Or is it those who are already engaged in a more traditional sense? Then one thing is, what is talked about in all these forums? So you have to know that for a long time in communication science, we actually by hand read and coded the content of everything, of news coverage, of television coverage. So now there are, of course, smart people in informatics department, for example, who actually program or come to algorithms that allow us to analyze the content of blogs, for example, in a big scale in no time. So that is due to technical advances. It's possible to kind of come to a better assessment of how political, for example, is the discussion, or how, you know, much of a quality debate is taking place there. If you try to define quality, you know, in one way or the other. Then one point, the power of small groups. So I showed to you that apparently in the Netherlands, not a whole lot of people are very active, but there are some people that are very active. And there's, of course, some benefit to actually further look at these particular people and kind of also consider their outreach and, you know, the amplifying or multiplying function of their activity. And finally, we have almost no cross-national research that is actually trying to compare things across countries, across cultures. We know, for example, that obviously in countries where press freedom is more of an issue, we have higher growth rates of people signing up to social networking sites. So obviously where there's a demand, we have a bigger increase. So it could be that, you know, in some contexts, these sites are just not the right place to look for political content because it's just not necessary. Okay, if I'm not mistaken, I am at the end now. I would like to point you to the website of all of those people at the University of Amsterdam who do research on political communication. This is not just online communication, but also really voting behavior, very different topics. How is Geert Wilders covered in the media and with what effect? We publish all our results. They're all made publicly available on this website. So if you once in a while want to maybe visit that website, I hope that you'll find it a useful source. With that, I hand over to you.